I see OKRs actually as something that is probably also, like I talked before about Agile, on the risk of being overhyped. Yeah, the companies see that, OKRs, okay, let's do that. And they're great tools and trainings and concept, and they just do it like they have done with Agile, before, which doesn't say the concept and the framework is wrong. Yeah? But it also, I think for me, is the most important that organization understand, again, the principles and the rationale behind OKRs. What is really meant by that? Not the grammar, yeah, how do you define it, but that is the thinking, yeah, the value it comes by focusing on outcomes and where we want to end instead of just starting a project or defining what teams need to do.
Welcome to another episode of the Major Outcomes Podcast. Today we are talking with Erik Lenhardt. He is a partner and director in the Munich office of the Boston Consulting Group, BCG. He is part of the leadership team for their global and their European agile and their software business. And he also, together with another colleague, is leading BCG's Agile at Scale business in Europe. Erik has been working in other consultancies like Solon Management Consulting, and he used to be in the management of the information department at Kabel Deutschland. And he has a PhD in national economics, studied among others in Darmstadt and at the LSE in London. Something that I'm always fascinated by in my previous conversations with Erik, that he's really, yes, he's a partner at BCG, but he really is close to these topics. He's really hands-on, and it feels like he gets the essence of agile transformation and the respective change in the ways of working that are needed for that. So he's also a certified Scrum Master, a product owner, and an agile coach. So tons of experience, lots of different projects in the last couple of years where we will learn from. Erik was also a keynote speaker at our Outcome Economy Summit last month. We're going to add a link to the show notes about this. And today we are going to talk about agile transformation, yes, but we are going to look a little bit deeper in some of the underestimated and sometimes unseen critical aspects to make agile transformations work. We're going to talk about decision making in the context of more agile, more resilient organizations, and then we will see where the conversation will take us. So thank you very much for being here, Erik. It's great to have you. Did I forget anything in my introduction for your background?
Good morning, Johannes. Yes, thanks for having me. Actually, this was quite a concise description of what I'm doing, what I'm interested in. So thanks for the intro.
Great. So our listeners are always curious. I mean, being a partner and director at BCG, obviously, there's a career behind that. But from your personal perspective, what got you there? Yeah, how did you find into the topics that you work on, but also into the company you're working at today? Like, what's your personal story there?
Yeah. Actually, I really had my enlightening moment that drove me to the topic of Agile. I was working at, I studied business computer science and then explored management consulting to get a broad view of topics. But then I joined Kabel Deutschland to lead the management information and data warehouse unit there. And of course, we did a lot of projects, IT projects, doing data marts, new data sources, new reports, etc. And we did it quite traditionally because that's what everyone was doing. And well, as many people experience, we struggled in this project, right? We were always under pressure and late, and it was not really successful, that in the sense that every project was on time and quality, and also we enjoyed what we're doing. And then we were doing a very signature project that we had to work on, which was a develop a new reporting system for video on demand. I mean, 2006, there was not streaming, right? Video on demand was the first streaming project, and we also wanted to deliver that. And of course, we had to know what are customers viewing, and we had to give the Hollywood studios back the viewing rates to pay them. So this was super important. And then there was a person coming, an external consultant, said, why don't we do it differently this time? Let's do it in Agile. And had no idea what he was talking about. And he trained us, right? He explained how we need to build a backlog, that we now work in these things which no one heard, sprints and all of those fancy agile events. And okay, we said, well, and I said, okay, guys, let's just do it. It can't be worse, actually. So we dived into that experience. And for me, it was enlightening because that project was actually on time. We were really productive and our internal customers were happy and the team was happy. And I said, okay, wow, this was such an amazing experience. It was so different. I want to do all of that. Yeah, I want to do all my projects like that. And then we, of course, rolled this out. And we also experienced what the challenges are by scaling more of that. So that was my moment. But ever since that particular product and project, I was saying, this is the way we have to work. And this is the way I want to work. And this was my start into the agile topic.
So that was in 2006, you're saying, right? Yeah. And that's interesting because, as you said, I think particularly in larger parts of Germany and most industries, nobody has heard of that. And then I really like how must have been a more authentic, getting to know each other, as a practitioner, right? I think just 5 to 10 years later, in many organizations, the topic has a lot of connotations, has sometimes bad associations because agile transformation, it's not just a big buzzword that's being used and put on a lot of things, but also oftentimes it doesn't work or it doesn't initially work or at least the expectations were set differently. So how do you look at the topic and how it evolved over the years? Not 2 decades, but almost 2 decades later, I assume agile transformations, and we both agree, are still a thing and having organizations become more resilient, more adaptive, is still more important than ever. But how did it develop and why is it still relevant today? How do you also position that topic today? Do you have to use different words and angles, but the essence is still the same? How do you look at that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, in 2006, obviously, few people have heard about the term, and we could just start into it. If you nowadays, or probably the last 5 to 10 years, talk to organizations and people, everyone has heard about the term. I think that's number one, that's super different. And people have experience, and as you rightly said, sometimes not good experience with that term. So it's a bit of a buzzword. And typically the first thing I do now, because now I'm in strategy consulting, I work with many companies across many industries. I first try to understand where they are in their understanding. And there's still people in the organization that haven't heard about this. Yeah? Mm-hmm. But there are many that not. And I start to see what are the client's experiences. And then start demystifying the word, because I fundamentally believe that the principles and the essence of agile ways of working are super relevant, even actually more relevant than they have been 20 years ago. But we need to demystify that. We need to say, okay, what is really agile ways of working about? And then probably connect it to what the organizations were doing at the moment. And some of them are not doing it the way actually the idea was born.
Mm-hmm. And do you sometimes meet customers who tell you, like, yeah, we tried that, didn't work?
Yeah, many of them say, yes, we're doing all of that, right? We have scrum teams, yeah, and we have squads, and we have these agile coaches. But if I am honest, it's not really working. It's not better. It's not faster. It's still messy. And then we need to look at, okay, what did they actually do, right? Mm-hmm. What did they actually change? Did they just introduce new names or new roles, or did they introduce new processes only, or did they change? And I think that's where the things really push comes to shove. Did they change the operating model of the organization as a whole? And I think typically what we see that organization try to do agile in a pocket, so agile in IT or agile just in software development and not integrating business, or putting new agile processes on top of the process they have already without stopping other stuff. And then we come to the notion, okay, what you did actually is something that couldn't be successful. It's not because the concept doesn't work, but the way you applied the concept. And then, of course, it's a it's quite a change in people's perceptions that they need to understand, okay, wow, what we have done is actually not how it should be. Yeah. And if then organizations understand this, and I have very good experience by showing them examples of other organizations that have done that, that have been successful, and the way they think, even with, say, some small details, right? The way, for example, decision-making is changing, yeah? The way classical reporting lines are changing, because if you just have traditional hierarchical functional organization and now say to people, you work in Agile Squad, but the way performance is measured, the way teams are steered is not really changing. How could this work from the individual level? And that's, I think, for me, that's a key point. But because in the end, it is, we want to make individuals work differently. That is where all the other stuff like operating model, yes, these are important words to change the context of people. But in the end, it's a behavioral change of individuals that bring the value of Agile.
Which sometimes can take some time, right? How do you look at like larger Agile transformation projects? Like, it sounds like you might meet customers or organizations who are different maturity phases, and then at least in our work at WorkPath, we meet organizations where it almost feels like they need to cross a certain hurdle to unlock the next level in their evolution, or some organizations need a relaunch. Like, how do you look at that process of Agile transformation? Is that something that is initiated and then takes 1-2 years? Like, what are your experiences there?
Yeah, so I think Agile transformations are a real change of the whole operating model. That's why it takes long. I think, first of all, taking the illusion away that you can do a project with consultants like us, run it 3 months, and okay, then you do a big launch, and then you're all Agile. I think this is just an illusion, right? Because people have learned over their careers a certain way of working. And now we tell them, well, actually, that needs to change. So they need to unlearn and learn something. And this takes time. So it's a real culture change as well. But the thing is, you can't change culture and behavior directly by saying, okay, this is now how you have to work. I think that is my key learning, right? People will behave rationally in the context that they're given by the organization. And just telling them to behave differently if it's not rational by the organization context, yeah, doesn't work. So we need to address both, right? We need to do this cultural change by working with leaders and showing them by examples, leading by examples, but we also need to change some of the wires in the organization. Yeah? And this is a large change, and this is also what organization takes time to learn. You just can't, of course you can always do a restructuring. I mean, many of our listeners probably we have gone through many restructurings, and then they say, okay, now comes another restructuring under the name of Agile, and this is not what we want. Yeah, because this will not be successful and also not long lasting.
So you mentioned a couple of important words there, restructuring, but then also really changing the ways of working for the individual. So let's try to pile the onion, let's say, and go from like level to level, because indeed, I think what a lot of organizations do, and they have sort of like almost a habit, a playbook for it. And it's the simplest kind of change where, it sometimes just feels like cosmetics, but at least you can show you've done something, is changing organizational structures. Yeah. But as I said in my introduction, like from structures to ways of working to decision making, there's like different levels. So is there a certain order of things, or the obvious kind of changes you've also seen more 8 to 10 years ago is that everyone followed the Spotify model, or you name the terms in squads and tribes, etc. Like, is there a logical must follow order, or how do you make sure you're approaching it the right way, but then also you're not skipping any levels, or you're just staying on a more cosmetic layer?
That's a good question. I think there is an order, but probably not the way that many people expect it, that you say you tackle structure first and then process and then decision making. But the starting point is to view the organization as a system. So we need to make a first step by changing the structure, the process and decision-making simultaneously, but not 100%. So you change a bit of structural elements, you change a bit of the way people work, you might change a bit of performance management and some decision-making in the first step, but together, so that they make sense, that you don't have any blockers in any of these elements. And then you need to approach it in an agile way. You also need to see, okay, let's do this for 6 months, and then let's see, okay, which elements, perhaps of structure or perhaps of governance, we still need to attack to make the rest work. And then you iterate. So you learn also on the agile transformation, which makes it also different, like many other transformations that organizations go through, because they're typically big bang, right? You define everything in every detail, and then you launch it with big posters and a big session, and then you're done. Here, it's not done, but you need to make a significant first step, which really changes stuff. And as I said, this is not just structure, and this is not just processes, and this is not just one thing like introducing OKRs. It needs to go together.
I really like that. And I think in previous episodes, we had similar conversations. It's something that we at WorkPath also come back to again and again. I think one of the biggest misconceptions in this context of organizational change is that you also should apply that new kind of mindset of going iteratively, doing experiments, and then continuously improve to the way how you change your organization. You're not just like flipping a coin or like switching a button and then you're there, but it's like this continuous process. As much as you implement new processes and ways of working that focus on continuous iteration, continuous learning, continuous adaption, it's probably the same philosophy that you should apply to the way you think about your organization and the development of that system. Yeah, that's why I'm always like, I haven't found a better term, but I think the transformation term, agile transformation, as you said, oftentimes applies. It is a process with an endpoint, but I think that kind of transformation never really ends, right? And also something where I feel like our ecosystem is growing more mature is that more and more leaders understand it's not about making all parts of the company, every department more agile, but depending on what like the work in these departments looks like and requires. And then I think the highest form of a competitive and resilient organization today is shifting also on that spectrum of agile and stable, or efficient and effective, or exploration and exploitation, right? So I think we've made some steps, but still there's a lot of misconceptions out there. How do you work with leaders in that context? Because ultimately, I think it always goes back to the role of leaders, any kind of manager, particularly if you follow what I'm saying, but in my point of view, a big shift in terms of leadership principles and ideals is you shouldn't trust and you cannot just work in the system and like manage performance, but you also have to work on the system all the time, right? How do you involve leaders there? How do you make sure this from the C-suite to the middle management to the team leads in the more operative units, that they can really drive this and become a part of it?
Yeah, so let me put that in the perspective of the transformation itself, right? Because I think one of the key things is that we define the why of the transformation, the outcome of that transformation very clearly, and don't focus, because everything that we said, like structure and processes and governance, is just output. Yeah, of course you need to change that, but the value doesn't lie into that. So I think the key thing first is, as an organization and as a leader, back to your question, we are very clear on why we are doing that. Yeah? And agile and all of the concepts behind, they are just the means. Yeah? So I think very, very clearly defining why is that now important for the organization? Where do we want to end? But also, how do we measure that? Yeah? How do we measure that we're making progress? Because when we talk about iteration, you need to have data to see whether you're working in the right direction or whether or not, if it really has an impact. I think that is one of the main jobs of the leaders in the organization, making very clear why we want to do that. Is it because of technology change? I mean, artificial intelligence, Is it because of supply chains disruptions where we need to react quickly? Is it about new entrants that we're having? Why is this change now necessary? And how are we going to measure the outcome of our change? I think that is number one key job of the leaders, to get clarity on that and define where you want to go. And I think the second step of the leaders is of course then to change, because to change the organization. Yeah, that is leaders' accountability. They have the mandate to change structures or to change decision making or to change what good is in the organization. And then the third thing I think also important is that they understand, okay, but it's not just themselves as leading the change, but they are also part of the system, so they need to change themselves. They need to change how they lead, right? They need to change who they promote and who they work with teams and where they give freedom and where they step back. And also it's really also a self journey, which I also experienced by myself. I mean, it's a way different thing to lead an agile team as an Abteilungsleiter, yeah, or to, yeah, to understand yourself as someone who tries to remove all of the roadblocks, but then lets the team do their stuff and trust the team, because you continuously see what they're working on, that they're working on good stuff or not.
Mm-hmm. So let's pick one of the, I think, more obvious, tangible things when we talk about leaders and the leader's role in that kind of transformation. Everyone likes metrics, likes measurability. Usually it's something you can like work with. Before we come to decision making and maybe how the role of leaders in the decision making process changes there as well, do you have metrics and examples top of mind how you would say that's how you can measure progress in organizational change beyond the ultimate final outcomes from a shareholder perspective? Do you have any metrics or milestones how you define that and how you make it measurable?
Yeah, typically I think you have a kind of a value driver tree, and one of the high level metrics is for example time to market. Yeah? Yeah. So how long does it and how long does it take us to from an initial idea to the first customer using it? I think that is, for example, one of the key metrics. A related metric is employee satisfaction. I think it's often neglected, but if people are motivated and see sense of their work, all of the other stuff, kind of being productive, being efficient, comes from that. So I think that is a key metric that we see and that we want to improve by agile transformations, for example.
So speed and how the teams are engaged. And I think engagement oftentimes, as you said, underestimated, not just as a way of looking at employee retention, but I think that usually also is a big driver of employee innovation, right?
Now, yeah. And speed not in the sense of more features per time. I think that is a misconception. That is also what I've seen clients do. They say, yeah, hey, we tried 10 times feature productivity and we are there. Yeah, but it's not the right features. Yeah, it's not what the customer really wants. Yeah? And I think that is one of the key things where Agile has gone wrong, and we need to redirect it.
Yeah. Also, yeah, just more output versus better outcomes. Right? Exactly. One reason why we are so obsessed with like really looking what does an outcome mean, and always define outcome as value for as customer or at least any stakeholder that you're very clear about. So, fully agreed. And I think we're going to talk about OKRs in a moment, but this is also where you see a lot of misleading key results in the earlier stages of these kind of transformations, where teams who are maybe doing this for the first time or haven't been enabled well enough, just measuring it in terms of more output, doing more, which ultimately is not sustainable, obviously. It's just sometimes more work and in the end, you're going to be somehow sobered and don't see the ultimate benefits of it. So that resonates strongly. So from metrics, as I said, I think that's something that's easy to deliver to a manager. This is how we're going to measure progress. This is what we're going to do. And as you rightfully said, also, this is how we make sure we're not measuring the wrong things, or we have kind of misleading vanity metrics. To a more sensitive topic, which is, I think, ultimately about power and decision making. It as one of the more underestimated levers, I think, in such a kind of an organizational change. I'm working with a systemic consultant who says basically any organization is a bundle and an endless sequence of decisions. So decision making is the key, the essence of an organization, and really what defines almost everything about culture and how an organization work. If we agree to that, and you mentioned decision making yourself as a critical point, wouldn't you say that leaders have to also like let go and give up decision-making power as part of that process? And if yes, isn't that probably the most difficult part?
So first, I would agree to the statement that the way organizations work, and but also actually the way we as individuals live our life is actually the sum of decisions. So I would agree to that. And changing decision-making, I would say, yes, it's difficult, but it's let's give you this example. We surveyed, we surveyed 10,000 managers, people who are defined by having the right to certain decisions, and checked whether they're satisfied with their work. And the result was, in every country, France, Germany, Italy, and USA, 67% of them are not. The only country that we surveyed where it's different is China. But in the majority of organizations I work with, the managers are not happy with their decision power, right? Because what they see, well, as a unit lead, team lead, business area lead, yes, they have the right to define what people should work on, how they should work like this, what good looks like, and all those details. But they ultimately feel they don't have the real power to do things, right? So if you lead a project, they don't have the power to make this successful on their own, right? Not even with their teams. They need all the other managers to collaborate, etc. And this is something that causes a lot of, I would say, unhappiness. So, and that's, for me, the angle to start with changing decision-making, saying, checking whether people are really actually happy, right? Because if someone is super happy and super content, it's very difficult to change. But reality is most people in organizations are not. Yeah? And this is mainly because of that, I think, I would say, illusion of power, right? They have decision-making rights. They have that formally, but they don't have it in reality. They can influence only so little in the organization context. And we try by the transformation to say, okay, what about giving you a decision structure where you have really invisible impact on the outcome, where you really see the effect of your decisions? And this is why, this is what really makes people satisfied. I mean, if we look at individuals, right, there are a lot of people who like to cook and do mechanical works. Why is that? Because they directly can see what their decision is influencing. And we try to put this back also in organizations.
So this might already touch up on one of the building blocks you also addressed during your keynote at the Outcome Economy Summit last month, where you talked about modularity, besides scalability and swiftness. So is this one starting point? Like, how do we change teams and team structures so they become more, from how I understand you, like more autonomous to have real decision-making power with regards to what they're doing and the value they're creating?
Yes, exactly. That's what I meant by modularity, right? These modules I was talking of are modules that have a value on their own, that then can define their mission and their outcome, and they can influence that outcome directly by what they work on, how they work, etc. And this is exactly the concept of modularity.
And if we stick to that topic, and we're always asking for positive examples, but you earlier mentioned there's lots of negative examples as well, where organizations in the past might have changed the titles and the names of these teams to have supposedly more autonomous and cross-functional teams that can act on their own. Do you have any, obviously this can be anonymous, any negative examples how companies might change those kind of things, but ultimately the quality of the decisions and the structure of the decision-making didn't really change? Why does that happen? How does that look like?
So let me give a practical example of an industrial goods company who did an agile transformation and they came up with 10 testing squads. Yeah, testing squads with a testing product owner and kind of all doing all those agile events and even calling them ceremonies, which is a word I don't like. And then we looked at, okay, what is the value that these teams are delivering? What is the outcome? And you actually see that the majority of them, 9 of 10, were not able to define business value of their squads. They all had a backlog, right? They had a long list of stuff that they're working on. And then we said, actually, but how does this integrate in the whole workflow of the organization? And we figured out that, well, these people are heavily dependent on the development teams and on the business teams. And they always need to say collaborate with them. At that point, they were just taking the testing items in their backlog and doing that on themselves. And then to change that, 9 of these 10 teams, except one, we said, well, actually, we need to dissolve them. We need to integrate them with the development team. The only team remaining was a team accountable for test automation. So they were building a product which the other teams were using, and we can measure the satisfaction of and the usage of their testing automation product. So this remains, and this team actually we saw was, in a sense, if we talk to these people, you had the feeling, okay, they see the value in what they were doing. Yeah, the other teams felt a bit disempowered, and this is natural. The teams themselves couldn't change that. We had to change the structure and also the governance for these teams.
So ultimately, this was about a more consequent change of structures, and what you described as what they had initially was maybe something more like a agile in a pocket where some teams change, but it wasn't really integrated along the whole value chain, as I understand you here.
Yeah, it was mainly changed. I mean, yes, the structure was a bit changed, mainly changed in the ways of working, but not with an outcome mindset, not like in a sense of having modular teams where you can say, this is the value that they provide, this is the funds we're going to give them, and then within that boundary, they are autonomous. They couldn't do anything except that one test automation team.
Yeah, makes sense. So one way I think of leading this conversation then and looking at organizational change in context of agile, or you can also call it resilience, adaptability, is you can either look at it from a structural point of view or more as a from a process-oriented, a more governance-oriented and decision-making point of view. And obviously, we mentioned a couple of these examples where companies find it easier. It's obviously more tangible to change organizational structures and roles and titles, team names. And it's a bit more, I think, floating or fuzzy, some might say, if we look at how do we make decisions. And that's why we do still believe in the value of frameworks. So I'm building a bridge. I'm trying to build a bridge here towards changing processes of prioritization and planning with frameworks like OKRs. Yeah? And here, as I said, we're not coming from how do we change our organizational structure, but how do we change the way we plan, we set goals, we prioritize, and then we collaborate around these goals. I think there is no right or wrong, but we see a lot of companies benefiting from, let's not make the big bang, let's not make the big organizational changes. Maybe they've been there already, but let's first start with simple changes in how we set goals, how we align ourselves around goals, and then from that process, we will take learnings and insights into other kind of changes. From that process, we might deduce data that helps us making smarter decisions around changing organizational structures. So again, whenever we talk about OKRs, whenever we talk about any kind of framework, I personally feel like emphasizing, let's not be dogmatic about it. Yeah, there's good principles in any framework. And as you said, we have to talk about the ultimate outcomes of what we want to achieve. But frameworks like OKRs do help to give the organization a language and make something which is a bit less tangible, like decision-making and goal-setting processes, more tangible and something that can be discussed and iterated on and brought into the company. How do you look at OKRs and how do you work with OKRs? What role do OKRs play in the kind of transformations you and your teams help customers go through?
Yeah, so when we help our customers go through agile transformations or resilient transformations, one of the key topics we address from the start is decision making, and we typically call this outcome-based governance. And in that realm, the concept of OKRs is a key integral part of what we advise our clients to do. And I see OKRs actually as something that is probably also, like I talked before about Agile, on the risk of being overhyped. Companies see that, OKRs, okay, let's do that. And there are great tools and trainings and concept, and they just do it like they have done with Agile before, which doesn't say the concept and the framework is wrong. Yeah? But it also, I think for me, is the most important that organizations understand, again, the principles and the rationale behind OKRs. What is really meant by that? Not the grammar, how do you define it? But that is the thinking, the value. It comes by focusing on outcomes and where we want to end instead of just starting a project or defining what teams need to do.
And then, couldn't agree more. Something I hear myself saying a lot. You can call it whatever you want. And you also don't have to take the full toolbox of whatever book you might have read, or also if you like go into a training and hear about everything you can do with OKRs, but understand like a couple of very simple ideas of getting the customer and the customer value, getting the outcome in your planning, getting real measurability with metrics that can be influenced into your planning. Like it starts with those very simple principles, where oftentimes when we introduce OKR processes from operative teams to the C-suite, leadership teams, oftentimes I think that's the low-hanging fruit, right? They experience a completely different quality of discussion and decision making right from the start. A lot of things wouldn't work in the beginning usually, but you have to learn it cycle by cycle, step by step. But that more principle and outcome oriented look at any kind of framework like OKRs, I think there we strongly agree. I assume the way you talk about OKRs, then all of your customers, depending on how they approach the transformation, there will be different kinds of approaches and flavors and focus areas of how OKRs are being introduced, I assume.
I mean, OKRs, the way they look at my clients, of course, are different. But the why we introduce OKRs is actually the same, right? We introduce OKRs as, in a sense, the glue between multiple teams or teams of teams to achieve the alignment on where they want to end, so that we can give them the autonomy to define the best way. And I think that's actually where the concepts lends actually quite well with also senior leaders, because what do senior leaders fear when we talk about Agile? They fear chaos. They fear everyone now going in every direction, thinking in the morning, hey, this is what we want to do, and now let's do that. That is what leaders fear. So the idea of having alignment between those teams, that they connect on where they go, actually resonates quite well. So if we introduce OKRs with that respect, I think the principles are the same. How it looks like, whether we talk about teams that develop software, or whether teams that serve the customer in the customer service, or if teams that develop hardware, then of course it looks different. But the principles, why we need to have OKRs, we need to have that transparency that OKRs give, right? That's also something that leaders, like everyone loves data. The only thing that we need to explain to them is why OKR is something different than the KPI, and how they need to look at that. Think about moonshot or roofshot OKRs and things like that. But the willingness to explore the concept, I think it's actually quite high at many of my clients.
And I agree. Oftentimes the part of OKRs is probably one of the more attractive tools or bits and pieces of a bigger organizational change. Actually, we just had a workshop with a new CEO of one of our existing customers that does OKRs, and I think there it is key about, like, this person, she is very, very numbers driven, obviously, has a controlling background, and showing how this actually extends the leadership toolbox. You have more metrics, actually more leading indicators that help you to react faster and not just always look into the rear view mirror, but really look onwards. I think that's something where, yeah, it's more of an easier entry for any kind of leadership team. That is true. Looking at the time, before coming to the closing questions, maybe we can close the loop. And yes, we talked about those both directions and perspectives. We talked about organizational structures and then organizational processes, governance, and decision making. Maybe if we bring that together, as I said, on the Outcome Economy Summit, you talked about those characteristics of highly resilient organizations. You talked about modularity, scalability, and swiftness. And we probably don't have the time to go into all three of them, but maybe you can give us one or two examples how OKRs, and coming here from the process, the decision-making side, how they contribute and help shaping a more modular organization.
Yeah, so let me go to the swiftness, actually, and the scalability topics first before going to modularity. So first of all, I think OKRs give the data to make decisions to go left and right with a very, say, short decision cycle. Yeah, that is what is swiftness, because swiftness means understanding where you need to go and being able to make those decisions. And if you don't have the OKRs to tell this, you can't be swift. You would be blind in your decision making and your steering. And scalability, I think here for me, OKRs link to the topic of investment and funding. Yeah, because scalability means descaling, i.e. stopping certain activities and teams and products, or scaling them up, investing more people, more funds. So in order to make that decision, you need to have items that you can define the outcomes, their value. Because you say you, if you need to scale down in a resilient situation by 30%, you would probably need to scale down on those 30% that provide less value for your stakeholders and for your customers. So I think they are instrumental to make these scaling decisions.
Mm-hmm. And then to modularity,
Of course, modularity. I mean, their OKRs are a defining element. Yeah. So one CEO I work with, he's a very strong character. He says, yes, I understand the concept of autonomy, but autonomy has to be earned, he said.
Yeah.
And in order to see which teams earns that, he said, okay, now I have the OKRs. Now I can look at the value that these teams do. And I don't have to go in every detail what they work on. I just look at the data, right? I look at the OKRs. I also look at the KPIs, things like the money and the funds they spend, etc. But that is the key concept, to have modular organizations that can run by themselves because they have their own value defined, and then they are autonomous in defining how they going to realize that value.
Okay, that's super interesting, actually. I have to ask a follow-up question. And that particular CEO, would they also say, like, depending on success of the team, on their KPIs, on their OKRs, they provide more, like, bottom-up autonomy in terms of how they prioritize, or how would they think about that? Because I think that's something that bugs a lot of leaders, right? Ratio of top-down and bottom-up?
Yeah. So I think the key thing that we worked with him and his organization at the beginning is defining their priorities very clearly and sequencing in a list. This is something that he said, well, of course, I know it. I have it in my mind. Yeah, but we wrote it down. Yeah, the company wrote down there in it's still a bit long list. It's 19 topics. Yeah, but still, for the first time, everyone knows what is more important than the others. And he always said, now I have the feeling that the organization understands where I really want to go, what is important, right? And the organization also says, okay, now finally it's clear what is priority over which, because at the beginning everyone had a large list of priorities, yeah, and was making their own decision what they thought would be important. But now we have this, also the priorities aligned to the leaders. So and for him that's also for him was a key measure that he said, okay, now I can go a bit loose because we have defined annually and quarterly, what is other priorities. I am confident that the budget allocated the right way. And then, of course, he is now focusing more on developing people, on the hiring and et cetera on that one. And it goes a bit out of the operational steering, which he has been before.
Yeah, yeah. It oftentimes starts with this seemingly simple things of defining the sandbox, defining the priorities in a way that everyone understands them, right? I think when we do our surveys with new organizations, oftentimes between 60 and 70% actually of people, and then still 30 to 40% of managers even, would say, we don't really know the priorities, or it's way too many priorities, so nothing seems really a priority anymore. So that resonates, yeah. Okay, so I could go on for a long time, but we have to come to a finish for today at least. So I'm going to ask you the same two or three questions that we're asking every guest on the Major Outcomes podcast. And we want to start with book recommendations. Any books can be in the top context of our topic today, but also beyond, that you would like to recommend to our listeners.
I have two things, one book and one not book, that I recently read that impressed me much. I think, hold it in the, not see if everyone is on video, right? It's a book from Roger L. Martin. It's called When More Is Not Better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's about America's obsession with economic efficiency. Mm-hmm. It's really a book that blowed my mind away, because he was thinking differently than I've been passed about where do we want to go with our economy, what is efficiency, and why it sometimes might not be the best things to follow. Really, really good read, Harvard Business Press, you know, with a lot of examples and the way. So this was a book I couldn't really recommend to your readers and listeners. And the other thing is something which is not in the book, because there's no book on that yet. I try to teach myself AutoGPT. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a bit of an automated way to use ChatGPT. And I really can recommend to everyone, either try to teach yourself how to work directly with ChatGPT, or if you're a bit more interested in software stuff, go a bit further, try that in a scripted way. Amazing. I think there's something coming to us as society, and the more, say, experience on the trenches you have, the more you might understand the consequences, and it's also fun to do.
Yeah, so for the book, for those of you who are only listening to podcasts and not seeing the video, of course, we're going to add a link into the show notes, and a big plus one on AutoGPT or ChatGPT. A lot of colleagues in my team are playing around with that, and I think, as it was said, it's a lot of fun, but also it will definitely play a role in many of our day-to-day jobs, I'm very sure. I don't think it's going to replace most of us, but I think those who are actually working with it and enjoy working with it, you can actually leverage your time and your capabilities by so much. So that's definitely an exciting one. Thanks a lot. Podcast, do you listen to podcasts? Any other sources of inspiration or learning that you would recommend?
So on a private note, I like True Crime podcast. I'm not sure if that's a recommendation you're asking.
Everything is allowed.
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of great True Crime podcasts out there. I mean, Murders from the Neighborhood is one. Yeah, not sure if you know that. And the Digi Kitchen podcast, for those interested in digital topics, from Thomas Kalker, is a great one, because he brings people together who have quite a different view on digital topics. So also quite nice podcast I like listening to.
Great. Going to put that into the show notes as well. So whoever wants to dive a bit deeper can check it out there. And then the very last obvious question, Eric, where can people from our community, or maybe people who've seen you on the Outcome Economy Summit, reach out? How can they engage with you or initially learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, I'm happy to direct them to my LinkedIn page. I regularly publish articles there. We've just brought out an article about agile and AI and agile in resilience. So everything is linked on my LinkedIn site, and people can also mail me via that channel. I'm regularly monitoring that, so yeah, happy to engage with your audience.
Awesome. And also, of course, that will be in the show notes for you. So this is it, Eric. Thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed it and hope we can do it again soon. For today, thanks for your time and have a great rest of the week.
Thanks, Johannes, for having me. Have a great day.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe to the Major Outcomes podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other major platform you might be using. Also, we'd be excited if you'd leave us a review. This helps us grow the community and spread the outcome mindset. See you on the next episode.